Well, hey, welcome everybody. This is Dave. I hope you guys are doing great. Thanks again for the responses, the questions you've sent in. I want to spend just a little bit of time, if there are any questions or any challenges that you've had by any of the materials so far. I'm most interested if you're finding it useful and applicable to your work as professional coaches, and take any questions or comments about a better applicability, perhaps. So how are you finding the material so far, and especially in terms of its usefulness for you? Any thoughts or reflections from anyone? Well, I welcome the comments that you've made through email, the questions that you've added to the initial questions, and I'm wrapping into our discussion the things that you've mentioned, and hopefully it's helpful. Hopefully it answers some of the questions, maybe raises others, but I'll put us on lecture mode in just a moment, unless there are other questions or comments from anyone. Okay, well, hold on. I'll put us on lecture mode. Okay, we're going to talk in this seminar about facilitating strategic change. I'm going to reference some of the questions that I have in the outline instead of going through each of them. You may consider saving them for looking at reflecting on your own experience to see if they may be useful for you, or to see if there are some that may be applicable to looking at the whole decision-making process that you are a catalyst for your client. So first, I want to bring into focus some collaboration strategy that we use every day as coaches, and kind of expand that and capture that to be perhaps even more useful. Now, we usually assume that meaning is created from the words we speak, and that people have the same meaning, or that our clients and us have the same kind of implication. But neuroscience research supports what parents of teenagers have known for centuries and regularly disregard. The first words spoken trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener or even the reader to boot up a specific mindset that then processes the remainder of the conversation. So a conversation that begins the first few words with remarks that are perceived as authoritative, critical, adversarial, activates the brain defensive circuitry of self-protection. A conversation that begins in a collaborative mode activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system that's related to bonding and connection. So this initial perception, just in the first few words, a collaborative framework can prompt our desire to listen, to collaborate without judgment, to pay full attention to who we're in a conversation with. The listener feels heard and understood. And we immediately then respond to a conversation as feel good or feel bad. This response boots up the mindset of trust and engage versus a mindset of fear and protect. As we then process information in the forebrain, we establish meanings that make sense and are logical and conscious to fit with and justify this initial perception. So we always find what we're looking for. We associate other beliefs about this situation or this person, drawing from past experiences, to further affirm our initial perception. This is another application of how state always comes first, state of mind, then strategy and story in our work with clients, and how it can make a significant difference. A state of mind instantly activates a specific mindset to determine the meaning we attach, and the meaning determines behavior. So think about it in this way. How is a political debate like a football game? Well, neither began with an immediate desire to want to learn or to create new possibilities. We immediately align with the home team or the favored candidate, and then find from that existing framework ways to confirm how right we are, how good the team is or should be, and pick a side and hope that side wins. We're not there to learn new stuff. So we reach conclusions and seek confirmation of those conclusions, confirmation bias. And that means we seek what we already believe and find ways to confirm it. A belief, a fact, is an anatomical reality in our brains. We often disregard or don't notice other possibilities. It just doesn't register on the radar, inattentional blindness. We simply stop seeing or hearing other points of view, cognitive closure. So change disrupts predictable known patterns, and that means it brings the experience of a kind of risk. If change is associated with pain, loss, or other less desirable outcomes, then no change equals no risk. It makes logical sense at that point to limit or minimize a fear that's associated with potential failure as a way of protection or just avoiding pain. So when somebody has a plan and decides not to proceed with it, it can't be said necessarily that they're sabotaging their success. They simply may be responding to the unspoken story of avoiding pain and finding a way to protect themselves. Our brain seeks certainty and predictability. When we anticipate the future, we become right about our predictions because we create the story to fulfill them. Yet by framing and looking at possibility, we give new meaning to mistakes and problems if it's framed in an inquiry, looking at possibility, looking at are there other ways to engage or proceed with this. Co-creating change involves a mindset of collaboration. The way we reframe and refocus and redirect our thinking determines how we will navigate the risks and challenges of our lives. Everyone is emotional at a time of change. If we assume it will be sufficient to give someone facts and explain why changes need to take place, we've simply overestimated the power of information and logic. There was a piece in the New York Times this Sunday called "Facts Matter, and They Don't Care How You Feel." A great article by Francis Collins. We assume that people are eager to change, that once someone knows things the way we know them, they're going to choose what we choose. We also tend to underestimate the power of storytelling, the appeal for positive emotions and connection to make a story with ways to synthesize and integrate new information with meaning. Storytelling appeals to connection and the positive emotions of belonging. Remember, we began in this discussion, our first seminar, talking about the coaching story as a way of conceptualizing each session we have with a client. So, how can communication be more effective? Communication is usually more effective when it's clear, brief, simple, and humane. The four principles of good writing and good speaking. We have a limited bandwidth for decisions. The brain prioritizes immediate rewards over delayed rewards. The greater the delay, or the less specific or the less evident a consequence is, the less likely it is to be chosen or to influence behavior. Neuroscience, those of you who have trained with me know how much of a stickler I am for this, and you've heard this before a few times. Neuroscience shows that we attend to and remember up to 10 words at a time. Beyond that, it simply takes mental energy to pay attention to more complex sentences and statements to figure out what they mean and how to apply them. So when you speak or write, keep the burden of clarity yourself. To speak effectively, consider this 10-10 principle. A collaborator of mine, Mark Wallen, Loyola Marymount Executive MBA head, did research using the 10-10 principle. He had groups of people raise both fists, and when they spoke, they would raise one digit. Each time they spoke a word, when they ran out of digits, they stopped. This will quickly train your brain to use 10 words or less in order to speak with clarity, brevity, simplicity. His research showed that when people did this in charged situations like divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, when they did this and agreed to speak only 10 words and then the other side did their turn of up to 10 words, this resolved faster using 20 to 25% of the usual time for a successful resolution, and the results were more satisfying and complete conclusions when they did this because they had all their cognitive energy and focus on exactly what they were dealing with. So let's look at a whole body of work, which you may be familiar with, but I want to apply it to us in coaching. Conversational intelligence. Here's a quote from a head athletic coach. I know what it takes to win games. I know how to condition the clients and how to map strategy. I lead the team by letting each player know what I expect of them and exactly what to do. The problem was it wasn't working. His outstanding athletes did not feel valued, respected, but felt judged, criticized, and they weren't buying in. They didn't sign on. They just became, as they experienced it, some expressed, a tool. The result was they were not close to peak performance and winning results. And this coach initially couldn't understand why his players were not taking his directives. So neuroscience and cognitive research shows us that a conversation transcends simple information sharing. It's way different and beyond that. Conversations are dynamic and interactive. They impact the way we connect, engage, and influence other people. The neuroscience of conversation informs us how to shape reality, mindset, events, and outcomes in a different way. So, from what that coach said, he knows what it takes to win games. He's going to tell each player exactly what to do. What's the antithesis of that? That didn't work. So if you want to do something different, that's a tenet of coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something different. What's the difference here? What's a different way to engage a player? Ask a question. This is what you guys do every beginning of work with a client. What would you like us to focus on? You ask the client to. You don't tell the client what they ought to know. If they have this phenomenon called Google, they got enough information. They don't need more information from you or me. But this is about engagement. Conversations are ways of co-creating a collaborative story. Understanding the anatomy of conversations can discern what works and what doesn't work. Conversations trigger physical and emotional states of mind and brain, which contribute immediately of how to process and respond to the conversation. State always comes first, then strategy and story. Conversations connect us with people, enhance our ability to evolve and develop individually as well as in a group. Mastering the moments of contact is the art of great leadership. We learn to notice patterns and how to influence them by specifically learning to focus and collaboratively engage. So if we experience change as frightening or threatening, our brains instantly shift to protection and vigilance. This state of mind contains instinctual networks to ensure that we're not harmed, that we don't take risks, that we avoid danger. If change initially is associated with loss rather than discovery, this mindset of protection is booted up. But if change is perceived as an opportunity and framed as possibility and discovery to learn about new and better things or ways and to expand potential, it instantly creates a different mindset. So think about this in terms of working with a client. The first words you use when they're in a collaborative way boots up a mindset of exploration. This is our framework as coaches, a collaborative framework to mutually explore from the client's point of reference to develop the client story. So there are three parts to enhancing conversational intelligence. This is in your outline, so I'm only going to do the highlights here instead of going through the details, so we'll be able to cover more. First is the frame. The frame determines the software program that you use to boot up to process the remainder of the conversation. You influence that framework for a client. Instead of asking for problems, you look at possibilities, at the point of reference initially being the client, what the client wants to focus on, where the client wants to get to, what they want to do to collaboratively co-create a new story in a specific area. So this means that questions are an opportunity to discuss. Instead of a problem, the challenge can be to explore possibilities. And here's key for one aspect. Every client, as each of you and as yours truly, will resist change. That's our brain's job description, to stay with the default mode, even though it may not work as well, even though it may have a glass ceiling. So this is simply the client showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. That means that can be approached in a collaborative way, too, to look at this as exactly what the client is doing. They're doing their job description to show you what it's like to be them, of how they think. They are expressing every algorithm that's there in their brain that determines feeling, behavior, cognition, their own sensation, the ABCs, affective, behavioral, cognitive, and sensation. They'll show you all of their ABCs. That's why we have to listen to the process as coaches. This is the conscious script that we're listening for, and we're listening for how it works, and this is great to do more of it, or even look for the bright spots, as we talked before, the one time that the problem didn't exist, which you may call the solution, and look at how to do more of it. Then after the frame, the focus, to look at how the client, and then ultimately the client and you, frame this challenge, an issue the client wants to deal with, and then redirect from problem, if that occurs, or from moving into a usual way of conversation, if that, for example, may be just speaking extemporaneously, to focus, to redirect there, or if somebody moves into something that is detour and distraction from the map for this session, from where they are to where they want to go, that may be where you want to ask, how exactly is that related to where you are? Does this help us see how you may move away from this at a certain point? And they may have insight about, yeah, this is where I feel uncomfortable. So let's look at an area that has not really been applied to mentor coaching, and I think it should be. And you see some outline material on appreciative inquiry. Dr. Diana Whitney, the founder of Appreciative Inquiry, was a guest in my mastermind group and described systematic studies of appreciative inquiry in organizations. And this is, you, I think I included this in the outline, her quote, human systems grow in the direction of what they persistently ask questions about. This is our job description as coaches. So there are three major aspects of appreciative inquiry to be applied, I think, by us as coaching in a very meaningful way. A focus on what works, to enhance what works. In other words, you ask about what you want more of than about problems or barriers or reasons or why. Lose all the why questions. Second, focus becomes a reality. A focus on possibility elicits a positive mindset, and a focus on problems elicits a problem mindset. I'll give you an example of that in just a moment. A focus on what works awakens possibility. This creates an aha experience in the brain that boots up a mindset that's more creative and synthetic and integrative. When someone has an aha moment, a moment of insight, three different parts of their brain light up on an fMRI scan. And that's what is state changing. When that same person, same hookup with the fMRI, is given facts, information, data, opinions, nothing lights up. So appreciative inquiry really looks at how a person or an organization can study and define the best that there is and then use that to build on what's already working. And this begins from a place of someone having more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of the past forward. So that may be reason enough to ask a question, has there been a time in the past where you've dealt with a challenge like this in a satisfying or successful way? Appreciative inquiry can get way better results than seeking out or solving problems, or especially giving the right answers. In a complex science designed, the appreciative inquiry is a complex science designed to not ignore problems, but simply approach them from a different perspective. Appreciative inquiry shows that collaborative strengths do way more than perform. They transform. Now, the most comprehensive survey conducted on approaches to managing change and enhancing performance, the context here is organization, that most organizations, teams, schools, companies, families, function on an unwritten and a misguided rule to fix what's wrong and let the strengths go. Let the strengths run. Take care of themselves. What really works, though, is to align strengths so that weaknesses become irrelevant and to know that some problems can't be solved but simply have to be outlived by generating current successes. An inquiry of exploration and discovery of new potentials and possibilities recognizes that the best in people or organization affirms past and present strengths and successes to build on them, to look at new directions and new goals. The questions we ask plant the seeds for the future. The questions set the stage for what we then find out and what we co-create, what we generate. What we discover becomes the stories out of which the future is both conceived and constructed. An organization story, just as each individual's, is continually being co-created and co-authored. So a simple question here. How does appreciative inquiry work at a brain level? Well, this is one of its strengths. Evidence from brain science research demonstrates how a positive focus is immensely more powerful in aligning intentions and brain energy fields to bring about and systematically pursue that focus and goal. Appreciative inquiry can be applied to self-talk to enhance confidence, A confident, positive focus is contagious, and a leader's positive emotions are more contagious than anyone else's. So why not focus on problems initially in order to resolve them in the usual sense of thinking, how to move beyond them? Well, there's a study, or a set of studies. Dr. David Copywriter studied this usual approach to identify problems and generate solutions, the usual consultant's position, focusing on the problems and the resolution. With matched situations for organization, asking a very different question at the beginning. Consider problems to look at possibilities and opportunities. He found that asking for problems creates a mindset of problem, while asking about opportunities and potential creates a mindset of new learning with significantly more positive results and a different experience for the group, for the individuals in the group. The act of asking powerful, positive questions affects individuals and organizations in their performance. The positive image creates a dynamic force in the individual, even in an organizational culture. So, for an individual or organization, appreciative inquiry can be the foundation of the interchange for a coaching relationship as well. So, here are four appreciative inquiry principles that can be used for engagement and to inform decisions. And I won't go through all of these in detail, but refer you to the outline. One, discovery. What's working best? Start with discovery. We discover before we dream. Every positive question cues a mindset for exploration. To discover personal or organizational attributes, what people value, how they hope to enhance their own or the group's vitality. Two, dream. What's possible? The purpose of possibility is to engage the entire person and system to move forward aligned with ideals and needs. The purpose. An invitation to dream exercises imagination and looks at possibilities. The bolder the possibilities and vision, the bolder the attitude, and the more successful the potential outcome. Of course, then, a systematic approach needs to be applied. So number three is design. What options can we create? Attention to creating a situation and a system to have a map of where the individual or the organization is, where they're going. This is the blueprint for the individual or for relations, roles, responsibility to further the purpose of whatever is the goal. And for destiny, what's an ultimate vision? To live the purpose, the principles, the blueprint, continue individual and organizational innovation that aligns with vision, values, and purpose. All of the individual, all of the organization is going in the same direction. So, I think I've included some appreciative inquiry tools in the outline. So I want to move to something I don't have in the outline, and an appreciative inquiry of patterns of decision-making that incorporate neuroscience. So, we usually focus, and we've touched on this before, we usually focus on what somebody decides. We focus on the content. But here we may ask, what's your best pattern of making decisions? In other words, do you process and do a grid and look at all the pros and cons, or on the other end, do all the research and then use your intuition? How would the optimum decision look and feel? How would you know if you've made the wrong decision? And what would you, in looking back, be glad that you've done? What would you, in looking back, regret that you've done? So here's an appreciative inquiry application for a common a prototype situation where a client feels stuck and wants you to help them get unstuck. So here are some applications for a situation like that for you to consider. What would we, and notice I indicate the we, not you. This is the we, the we-ness of the collaboration. How can we understand this? What would we see? What would we see to observe in your behavior to know exactly what you want? In other words, is there any behavior that is consistent with what they want and what they feel stuck doing? What behavior would demonstrate you acting to do that? And this is especially if there's no visible behavior on the horizon. Is there a component of that you could begin doing right now to get some traction? In other words, shrink the change to small steps and a first step to initiate it. Can you describe how you'd feel when you do what you want to do? That's the reason that we do what we do, is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. I don't work out every day because I love working out. I just know I'm going to feel like I'm doing something that I should be doing, and I'd feel lousy if I decided to, you know, take off and not do it. So that principle, that purpose, is part of an identity, and we always come back to and are consistent with our identity. So here's a couple of questions, because there are two motivations for what we do. One is to seek pleasure, and the other is to avoid pain. Now, avoiding pain is a little bit stronger. Actually, the brain registers twice as much pain if you lose $100 than the pleasure registered if you make $100. So that's a rough proportion. So if we do what we do because we imagine how we're going to, because we seek pleasure, and we don't do it, let's say you have, back to that illustration I mentioned very briefly earlier, if you have a plan and you get to the point that you're going to take that first step and you decide not to do it. So at that moment, what's your internal conversation? Do you bargain with yourself and say, well, I'll do it next Tuesday? Do you decide to defy your own authority? Well, the hell with it. I'm gonna go have a couple of great purchases on Amazon and go jog. You'll have to substitute your own excuses there. Or looking at, does it just scatter and you don't quite know what the first step is? So it always assumes the first step is to have a plan, to stick to it. You don't need motivation, as we've talked before. You need a plan to stick to it. So the last couple of questions might be, especially if there's avoidance or procrastination or some kind of whatever you hear that's getting in the way of having a plan and sticking to it. What's the greater pain if you don't do what you've decided or committed to do? What's the greater pleasure if you do what you need to do? So these may be questions that can help look at things in a little bit more of a mind and brain-based way that someone is just deciding automatically without scrutiny, and where you can help to really crystallize this process. So the question, how can you help someone change their mind? Well, the first coach to log in on this question was not officially a coach. He was a French mathematician and philosopher in the 1600s. His name was Blaise Pascal. He knew the answer to this. People are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they have themselves discovered than by those which have come into the minds of others, namely the other person, that's us. And Thomas Leonard, the father of professional coaching, Blaise preceded him by 5.5 decades. Pascal's answer was simple. Don't tell him to change or what to do. Evoke the reasons for change, the that they already have in their mind and brain to facilitate consideration instead of engaging the resistance. To engage something is an active process. To engage denial, to engage resistance. We look at evoking the reasons for change that are already in someone else's mind, our client's mind and brain, to facilitate consideration, not engaging the resistance. We empathically resonate, open-ended questions, reflective listening, and facilitating the client's story development. We want to foster change in ways that are consistent with how the mind and brain work. If information were enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, and have a lot of money saved up for the future. And a bunch of librarians would be billionaires. So, why does proven evidence not change our beliefs and behaviors? It's the same reason our suggestions and advice usually don't work. And here's the deconstruction of that. Facts as well as beliefs are anatomical realities in our brain. You don't create change by suddenly introducing a new idea and expect it to override the one that's already there. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change minds. It's simply not how we decide. If you want to do a field test on that, pick the closest adolescent, the first adolescent you run across, and try this out and see if it works. And you already know that your adolescent already has known for a number of years now exactly what you think and what your opinions are. They probably know them at least as well as you do. Does that mean that they've changed? Or that they have an automatic way to begin thinking about what their interest is? Established beliefs are extremely resistant to change, even when scientific evidence disproves these beliefs. The brain opposes new information to preserve the default mode. That's its job description. The brain's error detection mechanism activates when we receive any information that's contrary to what we already believe and know. So we seek confirmation of what we already believe, as we discussed just moments ago, confirmation bias, and we stick with the things that we already know. The endowment effect. We value something that we have more than anything else. The mode of default choices saves energy and sustains the familiar, but it can also result in stuckness and limit new possibilities. So I think we have to appreciate, maybe even empathically resonate out loud with a client who has this dilemma. They know the certainty of continuation, and they know the discomfort, the trepidation of doing, trying, thinking something new and different. So that duality is important that we appreciate so that we can help them frame when they do something new and different and it registers as, this isn't what I expected, the error detection mechanism says this isn't right, we can help them frame it as validation of a step into the new, the different, the unknown, that it's a signpost of being in new territory, to interpret it correctly, rather than this is my gut telling me it's wrong or my instinct telling me I've made the wrong choice. People regard information as valid evidence when it reinforces their existing views. Think about being at the football game. Think about listening to the political debate. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. Are you going to be less enamored and absolutely focused on the team you came into the stadium or the gym or the field rooting for? Are you going to be less favoring the candidate you want to win and you're looking for ways to confirm that they're better? People regard information as valid when it reinforces their existing views. That's how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. Just to reiterate that, because it's so important. Presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion causes that person to generate new counterarguments to further strengthen their view. This in neuroscience is called the boomerang effect. The more intellect, the greater intellect and the greater psychological flexibility, the more they're going to be able to creatively counter that view. As a result, people grow more confident in their original convictions and use information to further polarize opinions. Think about this as applied to controversial issues. Abortion, gun control, climate change. We quickly accept evidence that confirms our preconceived notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving eye. We then cherry-pick information to fortify our beliefs without even being consciously aware of it. In fact, recent studies have shown that, as I mentioned, the more intelligent people are, the more they can creatively rationalize and interpret information to fit their opinion. So they use intelligence not to examine data, but to draw more accurate and strongly held conclusions from their point of view and find fault in data that they already disbelieve. So the mind's desire for continuity and certainty, coupled with activating the brain's error detection mechanism with new and unexpected information, and the brain's proclivity to keep on the default mode because it's the most energy efficient, these all contribute to the continuity of existing belief. That's exactly why clients need us. We are the only professionals who specialize in doing exactly this, to help them collaboratively and creatively look at their own story, see what works and what doesn't. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. And the something else is also what we specialize in, to create a system for change and for transformation, and ultimately to incorporate that into the identity, the working model of how and who someone is, so that it can become automatic. So here's a little bit more about navigating with the brain's error detection mechanism. Our brain creates patterns of connections and ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, allow us to plan, predict the future, and operate automatically without having to think about everything. Discomfort and uncertainty began in a different journey than the one we already are on and know. And our brains have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that when we try something new, it will read, this isn't normal. This is an experience of discomfort or uncertainty or trepidation. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly then, patterns become hardwired and automatic. When that happens, we notice immediately when something doesn't fit a predicted pattern. This error detection mechanism in the brain functions to compare input with what's expected in the brain with what is perceived. Usually, this is highly useful from an evolutionary standpoint. This is why we exist now. So the error detection mechanism, though, explains a couple of dynamic factors. We notice differences more easily than confirmation. When something happens repeatedly, we don't even notice it often in our visual field. There's some very sophisticated research that shows when something is there consistently, we ultimately develop a blind spot for it. So it becomes easier to focus on the things we do wrong, and we struggle to list our strengths. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, as in you try to slip in a little advice to a client, or camouflage a suggestion in the form of a question, have you thought about, it sets off an error detection response, meaning that someone can reject an idea before even considering it, which can be another barrier to resist change. This is why telling a client what to do may trigger this error detection mechanism. To focus on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. It's something different, something unexpected. Bad news gets our attention for the same reason. The 5 o'clock news usually begins with a report of the meeting of the local knife and gun club. Now, the mental states, the mental maps, let's say, that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, like stress or in childhood, may simply not work in usual situations currently, even though we may automatically boot them. The hardwiring, the good news, the hardwiring is not permanent. It can be revised, which is why we're talking about what we're talking about. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, especially with collaborative, contingent conversations with the client as the protagonist of their own story and the coaching story and their life and other stories that they star in, they're the center of, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. The brain's error detection mechanism can be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system in this way. So what can we do as coaches then, knowing all of this, to catalyze change? Well, proven strategic tactics for change do not involve the physics of more information or pushing harder or enhanced maneuvers to convince. Remember, your prototype field test is pick the next adolescent and try it if you don't believe it. Ideally your own, because you only need a word or two, and they already got that built-in response. Instead of that physics, consider the chemistry of creating alternatives of choice that make sense and involve an initial, very small change. The collaborative framework that boots up a neurochemical system processed by oxytocin. So in a collaborative framework, what does this mean? Move from the familiar status quo to a very small, simple initial change. Shrink the change to a simple, clear next step. Alleviate uncertainty by making client-directed and initiate a specific immediate experience change of change manifest. What would be your first indication that you're taking a step in the right direction? Generate a sense of effectiveness by having the client create options within that plan rather than just one solution. This affects decision neuroscience because one decision may foreclose options and better solutions. Find supporting evidence from those who have made a similar specific change. See what works for them, compare with what you have in mind, and use this in a way to really reflect. Now, information is evaluated relative to our already established beliefs. So the further away from that any new information is from established beliefs and patterns, the more likely it will be considered invalid. So instead of challenging a really cemented belief, consider seeding a new one or looking at a single view of possibility or challenge. Instead of contradicting existing beliefs to show how wrong someone is, a collaborative model builds common ground. It has way more potential to persuade by collaboratively moving ahead step by step. So identify the existing belief, recognize the client's motivation and goals to extend the possibilities. So we all want to help a client or a colleague see things in an objective and informed way. To listen together to their unfolding story and collaboratively examine the fundamentally unconscious operating system that often contains biases, blind spots, and assumptions don't work, it requires that we collaborate and look together. So again, the antithesis of information and suggestion, like the athletic coach, to ask a question. Asking a question shifts the listener's perspective to one of participants to look for answers rather than to oppose or accept. Asking a question engages the client in an immediate collaborative framework. Initially consider summarizing their perspective in a few words or resonating empathically with their experience if emotion leads the way. This doesn't mean that you agree, but that you hear their point of view. This allows the other person to feel effective, that they have effectively communicated their position to you, because if they don't feel that effectiveness and you immediately start with your opinion or your point of view, they're going to just be kind of holding their breath, waiting until you pause to more emphatically state their point of view because they haven't felt effective yet. You didn't get it, and you're back to your position. So there are two people squared off, each in their own positions. This beginning of a collaborative framework, feeling understood, initiates a more meaningful conversation. The connection that activates oxytocin and the remainder of the content of the conversation when it's framed that way. We commit to what we co-create, so it's a collaborative framework. Now, advances in the integration of psychology, study of how the mind breaks, works with research in neuroscience, how the brain works, can significantly benefit coaches. We know more about the innate predisposition to the human brain to better inform about what works and what doesn't work and what to do about both. Now, changing behavior is really difficult, even when it means the difference between life and death. Here's an illustration. Coronary bypass patients whose lives were at risk unless they adopted healthier lives. They just had a massive heart attack. They'd come close to death. Unless they adopted healthier lifestyles, their lives would continue to be at risk. So, with all the information and the scare and helping professionals to help them know exactly what to do, how many of them do you think responded with all the significant information for change in their life-threatening experience with actual change? 1 in 9 change their habits. Studies of fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, study various emotional stimuli, which are used to help people make decisions that are in their long-term best interest. Whenever this engagement and activation by empathically resonating, collaboratively framing what you do together with a client, this is what has the optimum possibility of co-creating a different way of proceeding when it's done, especially in a systematic way, for the client. There are radically different ways that different parts of the brain operate. There are some fundamental paradoxes. We are literally of two minds when long-term planning and immediate gratification must struggle over the same dollar without tearing it for long-term savings. Making people happy is not simply getting more of what they want, because the pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects it to consider. So it takes more and more of the same thing to register in the same way of pleasure, the hedonic treadmill. Emotions do not simply and only corrupt decision-making. Emotions seize attention, motivate people to focus on the immediate, but those individuals who feel no emotion are not necessarily good at making decisions. It's been shown in a number of ways. So it's about engaging, to put it too simplistically, both sides of the brain, the emotional and the intellectual. We engage the emotional with that initial empathic resonance and resonate with the client's experience and collaboratively plan a systematic way to get to where they want to go. So I want to close with listing some see in the outline toward the end. But here are some ways, some essentials of engineering effectiveness. One, and this is sort of the bread and butter. You guys do this all the time. Focus specifically on the next step. An example here. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope, a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed, though, to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was interviewed and asked immediately after he finished the race. When he was exhausted and knew he had thousands of miles ahead, how did he keep going? He said, well, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. He did one step at a time. Now, he knew that the end of the line of the telephone pole was the finish line of the Marathon of Hope, but what he did was go to the next telephone pole. What's the next step? To specify the next step. Not abstract, not global. Some is not a number. Soon's not a time. Act healthier is not a specifically. So that when you make the step, you know it. Three, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going. This is the map that we talked about before. You want to measure progress along the way because that's validating. That enhances motivation. And it tells you what's a detour or distraction. Four, make progress measurable. A specific destination, tangible focus on the next step, and a way to measure progress along the way. Specific metrics. And five, make progress visible, small, specific, attainable milestones, and celebration of each victory. A really simple example, and it's been very successful, of shrinking a task to a tangible next item or focus is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. It's no longer abstract, staying sober. It's not something beyond the end of this day. A small target leads to small victories, the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. All you ever have to do is the next right thing. Now, you may not exactly know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. But this shrinks the change to immediate steps of effectiveness, the noticeable, measurable momentum, and the experience of effectiveness mastery. That's the most, the experience of effectiveness is the most fundamental motivation that we have as human beings. I've seen direct infant observation studies of kids as young as 3 months of age who have effectiveness pleasure. When they bring about to cause something, a behavior that causes something, they have an effectiveness pleasure that registers. This extends through our last breath. We want to be effective. We want to experience mastery. So this is what we do as coaches, is to provide a framework, a context, and a collaborative map, session by session, and over an entire coaching engagement, to be effective, to experience mastery, so that you know if this person sticks with you for coaching, they're going to be beyond where they've ever been before, beyond even where they can imagine. We'll talk a little bit more next time about unprecedented experiences and experiences that result from success that someone could not actually have experienced or know or plan for necessarily, about what we do with that as coaches so that we can be ready for that as well. So, I'm sorry, we have just a minute or two. Let me get us off presentation. Clarification, thoughts, questions, anyone? If you have any that you think of or that you want to be sure we address, or that if you think of in reflection, or for those of you listening on the recording, fire off an email. And if there's anything that you want to be sure that we discuss in our final seminar next week, be sure and let me know, because I want to incorporate that. I'll review again the questions and the objectives that each of you sent in, so that this will be hopefully a very, very useful experience for you in enhancing what you do as coaches and work with clients in ways that can incorporate some of what we know from the mind and brain and science. Thanks for your attention, for all the things you've sent in, the positive words. I appreciate that. Feel free to email me for anything that you think about or want to add or ask. Until next time, take good care of yourself. See you guys. Bye.
Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye now.